On this week's show, discussing, can construction define and achieve the digital twin? With Alexis McGuffin from Suffolk Construction. In this week's news, are tech companies finding the end of the internet? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, Jacob, Monday morning, we're here, we're on the microphone. It's a good place to start the week.
Yeah, it is. It is. Actually, I think this is my first podcast with you that I've done on a Monday morning, Jeff. This is new, but I'm ready to go. I think it will kick off the week very well.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of Monday morning ones, but, you know, it was one of those weeks. It's been a busy few weeks, got to get a couple in. So, Alexis, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. We're going to just dive right into this. So, Alexis, let everybody know a little bit about you, what you do, who you are, and we're going to dive right into some fun conversation. The pre-call was great.
Sure. Yeah. Alexis McGuffin. I'm the National Director of Digital Delivery at Suffolk Construction. And, you know, I spent beginning of my career was in ops, project management. Then I moved into BIM and BDC, spent about a decade there. Then I moved into business development, still focused on tech, but kind of across the business in general for a couple years. And then coming up on 2 years ago, moved into this role at Suffolk.
A lot of your digital path, a lot of that, especially at Suffolk, you guys have really, you know, doubled down on the power of technology and innovation in the industry. I heard you mention business development, you know, moving from operations. Go back to your operations days. Like, what intrigued you about technology and its application that could, you know, really drive construction forward?
Actually, so my bachelor's is in software engineering. Mm. And then kind of found my way over to the School of Design and Construction in my master's. It was less about, you know, knowing what I wanted to do and just kind of chasing interesting puzzles. So I really like to solve puzzles, complex issues. So I don't have any, you know, architects or builders in my family at all. Kind of surprised I ended up here, but it just really attracted me because it's so hard. It's so challenging. There's so many inputs, so many personalities. Psychology is a big part of this, right? Just because you're right doesn't mean you're effective, right? And then also just building complex structures that interface with the earth, the environment, the inhabitants, people. There's just a ton to consider. So how do you maximize success in that space? Just kept me here. You know, I'm probably coming up on close to 20 years. 18, 20 years in the industry. So, and it's kept me here. It's been fun.
I like that. Coming from the digital side and, you know, computer science and then moving into it, large problems. I like that we approach this and that you approach this as, you know, a giant puzzle. I've heard it, you know, obviously we relate it to Legos a lot. I'm coming off of an event where we did another Lego serious play simulation. And I find people don't understand how much of a part of the problem people are. And I liked your quote, just because you're right. What was it? Just because you're right.
Doesn't mean you're effective.
we're stealing that one. Mm-hmm. Cause it's true. Talk about a little bit about how you came across that and maybe some of the things you're doing to overcome it.
Sure. I mean, my husband's in real estate development, and often we around the dinner table talk about how the biggest challenge that day was really the people. It wasn't really the technical side, how to get it done, right? It's the people. You know, and I realized that being able to build advocacy and get people moving in the same direction, facilitating deep collaboration, we're not set up as an industry, design, engineering, and construction to actually deeply collaborate, right? The contractual structures that we have to work within, the insurance piece, right? The way that designers draw and model towards a design goal versus the way that we actually procure and build are different work streams. They don't meet in the middle. And then if it's design bid build, look, we've tried with design build and IPD. IPD hasn't really caught on, right? So we've tried to kind of do deep collaboration and we haven't realized that dream, right? And BIM is a part of that. That was kind of the tech piece. Well, maybe we can all kind of get around a model. We all kind of go, you know, I don't think we need to go there again. We've been talking about it for 10 to 20 years about the, right, why BIM didn't realize our ultimate dream, right? The people piece is just, if I can get people around the same thing and get them motivated, we can build trust and actually overcome all of those contractual, mechanisms that keep the friction in the way we work, right? There's a lot of, I think everybody hopefully in their career has the opportunity to work on a project where we read the contracts and we go, okay, we know what we're supposed to do, but well, let's get it on the table. We all know we can do it better. And let's just kind of shake hands and be nice to each other and do this in a way that we know is better and faster and more collaborative. And so that's a people issue, right? That's a people problem to solve.
Yeah. I want you to go a little further. What would good, deep collaboration really look like?
I mean, I think the first thing we need is trust. Like I said, you could actually work around contractual obligations if you trust people. And I think that that's probably the issue, right, with IPD is that you get into relationships with entity, you know, other firms and stuff that you might not necessarily trust and want to work that way. and I think deep collaboration is a safe sandbox for all of us to check all the boxes that our organizations require us to check, both on the data security side, the legal side, all of that, but actually just act like we all work for the same company, right? So like form a team of separate teams around the singular goal of building a successful job, because contractually, we might not be aligned in that goal, but in truth, we are all there to build a great building or project. So I don't know. That's a bit of a vague answer for you, right? I didn't really actually answer that. But I mean, I think probably like technically, if we move closer to like DFMA, right? Shop has done this, right? Like I highly admire shop architects and the way that they are able to work when allowed, right? And we just move towards kind of, yeah, like we're building a digital twin. We're working collaboratively as if we work all for the same company. We're skipping kind of the onerous parts of the process. We're all huddled around the same model as it continues to evolve. And we go right into manufacturing and we're doing assembly on site instead of construction on site.
So I love that. First, we're going to go back to where you came from here, and you don't have to be shy about mentioning your alma mater. And Jeff, we'll give you a soundbite here. It's great to
I'm
be
a, Gator.
A Florida Gator. It's great to be. So moving on from there, I actually think you answered it right. You said you might not have given yourself an answer or given an answer to that Jeff's question, but you actually hit a home run. It was trust. Literally the biggest thing is, can we trust the other people that were sitting in the room? And when it comes to the end of it, is it the fact that we're going to rely back onto, well, this is what my contract said. I don't have to do anything else for the project. And that's where we start having the pitfalls. That's where we start having gaps. And that's where your two work streams miss. Really, it's about that trust. And I think that was kind of the correct answer, because it's funny how if you're old enough now to know what BIM was and what it was supposed to be, and it was supposed to be this, like, you know, golden egg. We're going to solve everything with BIM and everything. And now we're old enough to be this little bit more cynical about it and be like, it's the people.
We're a little curmudgeon-y now.
Yeah. We've grown old. We're the older people that actually said, no, BIM's never going to work. And now we're like, well, if it's only the people, if we could trust each other, we can really make this work. So what is next in that step then? How do we start getting, if we know it's not process, we know it's not technology, technology's finally caught up. If it's the people, like, what are you guys doing on Suffolk that's actually trying to solve that problem?
Our solution is kind of what we've been, I wouldn't say you know, forced into, but it's look, you know, I say this when I talk to, like, you know, my design and architectural engineering friends and stuff, like, we can't wait. Right. This isn't a power grab. This isn't a control grab. We're going to do everything. But, like, our clients are asking us to deliver on time and on budget. I have to give them predictability. And if your instruments of service, if your drawings and specs, right, are not enough for me to do that, and if our our contracts are at odds with each other, some clients like the friction to try to keep people honest. I still don't think I think there's probably a better way to do that. But if our contracts are at odds with each other, then I just have to do it myself, right? Like, I mean, you see this on a small scale, like laser scanning should probably be done by, like, a design team, but, like, we do it, right?
Yeah.
And in the big picture, you know, we have now an engineering firm. We have Suffolk Design. We have Suffolk Technologies, which is, a little bit of, like, rabbit holes and stuff, but I really like at Suffolk our decision-making process around build, buy, and partner/invest. So we have, like, you know, an investment Suffolk Tech, where we invest in emerging tech and we can partner. We have, like, Liberty. So we have self-perform capability. We have, you know, we just have all these different businesses to plug all those holes and gaps and make sure that when it becomes our responsibility and our risk, we can run quickly. So the answer to your question kind of sounds like, oh, we're just going to do it all of ourselves, which removes some of the collaboration, but we can't wait. Like, we can't tell clients that we're waiting for instructions on how to actually build this. We have to fill the gaps. And so what we have done is build a platform from which we can provide the right information at the right time to our project teams in order to deliver that. That doesn't answer your question about the people issue. I don't know how to answer that because it's a huge industry with a ton of personalities. We can't go around and we can't trust everybody. Like, it's just not, you know what I mean? And like we said, we try to put those contractual, like, IPD contracts in place and they didn't take off. So I don't know that we have an answer to the trust piece. I think that's a company culture thing, right? I think that's being transparent, but how do you actually define transparency to your clients? And I can go into how we've decided to address that at Suffolk. But I think what you're seeing is construction management firms just taking on more and more and more of it for what we can control, because we can't control the clients and the design partners when they're external.
Yeah, it's a matter of
not the answer you're looking for. But
no. I mean, it is. It's
something we can't wait.
Actually, I think that's a great way to put it. But I mean, it's a matter of, well, willing to take on more risk if you can control it versus having that out of your hands and not have the risk. So it's a matter of, like, hey, well, you know, it's a bigger issue if the risk is not controllable for us. So we're going to control it. We'll take it on. And to me, I think that presents the opportunity for better trust, because you are collaborating with, you know, a company that was built on that foundation versus individuals that have a set goal to themselves and then having to be forced to collaborate with other GCs. Jeff, you got something down there?
I mean, risk's where the money's at. Always is, right? And it's good business to take on risk that you can manage and that you're good at. I think that's one of the fundamental things that we don't acknowledge. We also, one of the problems is we'll trust each other for just long enough to then, you know, get it close to done and then start fighting over scraps. And I think that's another large issue in the industry itself, is that, you know, we say this all the time, I'm stepping over dollars to pinch pennies, because there's just so much to be shared. That was the idea behind IPD contracts, right? Show me how I'm measured, I'll show you how I act. If we all are sharing in a big profit pool, great, but then humanity gets involved in it at times. What I hadn't heard, Alexis, that I wanted to go back to and dig into is what I think is actually going to be the real change. You guys are self-performing now. You're really digging into, and I've had a chance over the last 3 years to dig into DFMA. And DFMA exposes a big problem for us in the way we build, the way we design, the way we go through the process itself. But at its crux, it's showing us we got a skilled labor shortage, and everybody hates to hear it, but it's true, and it's not going anywhere, right? So I'm interested in how that respect for perspective for the trades, the self-perform, and even supply chain now, right? Like supply chain so volatile. How can taking a I'm really interested in digging into, I think taking a DFMA mindset can actually bring owners around to understanding why it is we do all this. I think that, you know, one of the basis of trust is like, I understand why you're doing it. I think for a while it's just been like, oh, you just want to be fancy or whatever. It's not that. So I'm interested in how DFMA became such a key proponent or portion of this, you know, push.
Yeah. I mean, I think those that are pushing towards industrialized construction or right, like that's the direction that we need to go. I mean, I don't know, to answer your question, you know, look, starts with prefab and modular and components built offsite. There's a huge safety benefit to that, controlling it, you know what I mean? You're not like kind of out there figuring it out. Like I said, I think it's just a move towards industrialization and removing the unknowns of the field. I'm kind of searching for a better way to answer your question.
So I'll poke at it a little bit too as well. I think if you go from the other perspective, like there's this belief that if we design for manufacture and assembly, if we do DFMA, we do more modular, we do more prefab, we're actually limiting what architects can do, what they love to do. You know, I think there's this belief that it's going to ruin the craft or ruin the, and it's, that's actually not the case.
My last firm, right, was investment, development, and construction. And the development side was always pushing against the construction side because they always wanted all of their buildings were obviously like precious and they wanted them to like reflect the local neighborhood and be a bespoke design, right? So I get that. I've dealt with that. And I think potentially this is where the tech and the digital twin can come into play, because if we can create a complete twin environment and we can link supply chain and a procurement plan and the schedule, the budget, all of those things to actually validate them against each other to make sure that that works, we can let a design architect design something beautiful. It doesn't have to be necessarily modular, like all the same, the way that we think of modular, like we have three unit types. We have the studio, the one, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. It just has to be built ahead of time virtually and offsite in parts and delivered in parts that click into place. Do you know what I mean? That's why I mentioned shop earlier, right? Like they've demonstrated that capability and we just have to do it that way. So modular doesn't necessarily mean it has to be the same. It doesn't have to be IKEA built. It just has to be done digitally ahead of time. And if we have a twin, we can validate that the schedule and the budget, right, and the WIP and labor hours and all of that, actually supply chain, like if all that is linked, we can simulate it to make sure that what we've planned for can actually be accomplished. And maybe that's just like the dream, you know what I mean? But at least it's a guiding light. It's like the direction we should be going. We might never fully get there on every job, but
no, you're right. And it is, we have to have a dream, right? We have to have a place. We have to have the end in mind. Is it, are we always going to get there? No, it's, you know, change, adapt, overcome, make your changes along the way. But you hit on something, because I think it goes again back to the people. And I think this is the unfortunate part of the power of BIM and some of the other tools we have, is that we feel like we can keep changing them. And if we're going to do offsite, if we're going to do supply chain, we're going to connect all of those dots. There are moments in time when decisions are made and we might as well have the building built at that point in time, right? We have to not change it. And I think that's a huge people problem, because they think, oh, it's on the computer, we can change it. No, it's already being fabricated in a shop. It's already ordered. It's already on a container ship headed to where it needs to be. So again, you get back to the people problem. Like, we can let designers build beautiful things. We can let owners have say in the things that they want, but there are moments in time when it can't change. We've got to stop.
I think there are probably three components to that. So one, yes, the people part, culture, right? Like just kind of educating and training clients, like this is like the reality of, right, the way that we build, that we need to build. Part of that goes to transparency, though, right? Like, if we can set up a system where we're totally transparent with the clients and we don't build in any, you know what I mean, any float, any fluff, any safety nets, and we do, but we agree to them and we show them everything, so that they don't think that we're like, you know, we're kind of squirreling away like extra time and dollars. Like, if we're completely open book, okay. And then third, with the tech, like, let's say, like, if we try to do that with today's timeframes, then I don't think it would work. But if we could deliver like that twin in the way that I described, like go from a set of DDs to a twin in 60 days, 30 days, client could change it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so fast. So who cares? Right. And then we just have kind of like the last responsible moment defined. Right. And change it again, because it'll just take us 30 days to make that change and rerun the simulation and make the adjustments to the twin and validate it. So like the tech piece could actually help us do that, you know, DD to basically as-built process a lot faster. Maybe it won't matter.
Well, there's a moment, though, it's got to go to the shop, right? And then once it goes out for the order, the procurement, then we got to stop. So, but you're right, because it takes so long, and because look, how many times are we redrawing everything? Nobody trusts anybody else's drawings at all. I sit all the time in the room and they're like, oh, well, I take those and I throw those away and I redraw them. Okay, this is a huge problem. Like, digital waste is waste. Get over it. It's done. Like, we have to connect these people. We have to allow designers to do the things they do, but we have to allow our trades to do what they do. And it's got to be together. And then if we could do that in 30 to 60 days, you're right, in 12 months, you can spend 12 months. We spend way more than that in pre-con right now, and we still don't get to a better result sometimes. Now we could have a really cool result in really short period of time with all the, I'm going to call it the physical bells and whistles that our owners require and that our environment requires, right? Like, it's not just all projects of, you know, a high rise or, you know, something fancy. You know, this is wastewater treatment plants and, you know, electrical stations and, you know, our grid's dying as we speak.
Life or death infrastructure, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, like truly.
Yeah.
So I want to, for the people that are driving right now and they're sitting there yelling at their radio about digital twins. And we're sitting here talking about digital twins, and what we're talking about right now, I'm going to do a little, put my Bob Ross hat on and paint it for them. Is we're not talking as much about that BIM FM piece. We're not talking about, hey, how does a digital twin operate in or go into building operations? But the idea that a digital twin can live across a building lifecycle, and that we can, you know, deploy and leverage digital twins during design and then during construction, and still gather all this information and still use what Jeff calls that data twin. So to paint that picture, and kind of where Alexis here talked about going from a DD to a digital twin. If you think about current design process, right now, a DD set to a CD set, you have interns basically cutting pages and pages of column details. And then they're drawing out the column detail and they're moving forward with it. If there's a point where instead of drawing those out, you could build the twin to the correct idea of what column is going to be, or what that wrap is going to actually go around that column, the drywaller can literally go cut the section and see that you're doing just a 1 foot by 1 foot wrap and centered on the column. And they can go build that. That is something they can use. But in that same scenario, you're understanding, you know, how much linear feet of drywall you're going to be able to pull out of it. You're understanding how many studs that might be going through there. Understanding, you know, how much square footage of drop ceiling you're going to have. So now if you're doing this during this, you know, DD to twin phase, and Alexis mentioned, there's still change. You can actually make a change there. And as we update it, that data then all of a sudden updates down the road. So now we're actually incorporating supply chain. Now we're actually incorporating construction schedules. All right, well, that's a lead time. This is not happening when you receive a CD set and then you have all your pre-con guys go back through the CD set, mark it up, trying to calculate everything. This is much more of a fluid, deep collaboration, like Alexis is meaning and talking about before, but we could. I mean, that's a huge opportunity with a digital twin, right? To have that data, to have that. So just wanted to throw that in there is we're not talking about that BIM FM piece right now. We're talking about what we could do actually in design construction.
And I would also say that it includes the manufacturing, the fabrication, the delivery, logistics. It includes the actual activities of creating the materials, bringing them to site, the movement of materials and people on the site, the constructability of putting these things in place, time-based, all of that in there to validate, right? Like, again, maybe I'm talking about pie in the sky dream, but I'm thinking when I'm talking about a digital twin closer to an airplane digital twin, a washing machine, like what GE uses, right, to build their refrigerators, whatever. They have people shown in the digital twin in the actual factory and the robotics putting this all together and then simulating a wash cycle. Like, that's what I'm talking about in terms of a true construction digital twin. Now, we can talk about if that's actually possible or how should we define digital twin within our industry. Like, that's a separate conversation. But conceptually, like, that's what I meant. You know what I mean? When I was talking about being able to go from DDs to essentially like an as-built in like 60 days because you can validate that it actually happens because you watch it. You watch the simulation.
Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress. And you always get the "I'm fine" answer, but always try to dig a little deeper because people say, you know, I haven't been sleeping great, and I'm really eating crappy food, and I feel anxious, I feel depressed, I feel, you know, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on. There's some great resources, and if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptom survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working, and then we can correlate those two. And if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if burnout's the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention. And start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like, most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. You know, this is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and really check in.
One more resource in there, the Tough Guy Survival Kit, guy being gender neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there, and it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
Yeah, and that's where I come in with the data side that Jacob mentioned is the data twin, is because part of that is consuming data from all of those different places, whether it's the supply chain, whether it's the trade partners, whoever it is on, you know, status of where things are. That's another, you know, we are very used to in construction. If I can't see it, I can't measure it. It's not happening yet. In DFMA, so much more is going to happen offsite that I think digitally knowing where it is, tracking, connecting the supply chain to when it's going to get built, and then seeing it happen. You know, you talked about trust. You know, tell me what's going to happen and then show me. And then as I see it, I am going to build that trust that I can trust that this is going to happen. And that's going to build over time. I mean, we're not going to get to your sort of promised land without a few hiccups, but that's the other, right? Another one is when a hiccup happens, because they do. I mean, this is, you're talking about major logistics here, getting things on site, you know, roads shut down, things happen, but then we try to hide it. Or we try to play three card Monty and you can't figure out, if we're transparent and we say, this has happened, this is how we're going to deal with it. We're going to sit with the team. We're going to figure out what's our plan, how we're going to roll. And we talk about our mistakes and we pick our partners up. That's the other part of, if we're going to all act as one company, then, you know, if someone, Alexis, on your team falls down, you pick them up. We love, to Jacob's point, to go back to the contract when they fall down and kick dirt on them while they're down there. That's never going to get us to where we want. Some of the folks in our industry have the scars to say, this is why I won't get involved. So that's why I go to that data and those places, because it's really not about when it goes well. It's about when it goes wrong. How do we act?
Yeah.
Well, our whole industry is built on how it went wrong. Every single code is based off something going wrong, and they put a code in place to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Or every contract is looking backwards at the way I was screwed before. I never put the clause how I'm going to get screwed in the future, because I don't know. I put the ones on how I was. That's why our contracts look like they do.
Yeah, and we also, right, like, I think a lot of times clients and owners like some friction between the parties, right, to maybe, right, drive costs. Keep them honest, create competition. Like, how to, right? Like, a lot of clients will say to me, well, like, yeah, I mean, design build sounds great, or even like design assist, but like, how do I know I'm going to get the best price at the end of the day? So it's like, they like that friction. I mean, some of them do, right? Like, and they, right. So.
Well, I go back to my weird times way back when in other jobs running a bar. And I've worked in three different environments at a bar. One where absolutely zero drinks allowed for anybody on the staff, for anybody to give out to customers, anything. Highest liquor cost I ever worked with. Why? Because that kind of command and control will only keep me acting the way I'm supposed to. Not me, but acting the way I'm supposed to until you're not looking. Then I'm going to take extra drinks. Then I'm going to give my, if it didn't get rung up and the bartender gave it to me, I'm going to give it away. Right. Then the second one where it was like, hey, I'm going to give you this bucket, the IPD bucket. Here's $40 every night to give away to your customers or accidents that happen, et cetera. Okay. A little bit better liquor cost. Or my last one I ran, it was, listen, I'm going to sit down with the staff. I'm going to talk to you guys about what liquor cost is. I'm going to explain to you how it works, how we're measured, and how that not only drives our bottom line, but how much I can pay you guys, et cetera. Which place do you think I had the best liquor cost? The last one.
Of course, yeah.
You trust them.
Yeah.
Right? This is the thing. Command and control just keeps me acting the way you want me to until I'm out of your sight. It's how do you act when you're out of my sight completely and I've given you enough trust to act accordingly? You're going to do the right thing by the project, by the owner, by what we're being, by the project itself. So, and I don't understand maybe why we fundamentally don't get that, Alexis, because I hear that friction and cost thing all the time. And I'm like, I think it's because we don't do a good job of quantifying the total cost of that kind of environment.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that. And I have clients who understand that. They understand like the cost to their morale and their turnover and the health of their team members working overtime. Those hours aren't like billed. Do you know what I mean? We're all salary people, you know, at corporate and everything. So, you know, but I have clients who understand that, and they have clients who don't care. Do you know what I mean? 40-hour work week is really 800 hours and they only paid for 40. So, I mean, I just don't know if we can solve for that. I mean, at least I'm not smart enough to solve for that piece. So, you know, what I can do, you know, I'm trying to control what I can control, right? And by me, I kind of mean like Suffolk in general, right? So if trust is an issue, what's my small part I can play in that besides company culture, right? And the executive committee, you know, the executives acting in the way we want everybody to act. Like we have an owner's dashboard. So what I love is when I go and talk with clients, everybody says all the buzzwords, collaboration, transparency, blah, blah, blah. I can point to something and tell clients, this is what I mean. And it's a dashboard where all of those things are available. They're updated every like 10 minutes. It pulls from like 32 systems. There is no opportunity for a project team to filter the data before it goes to the client. And this was like a legal battle. Like our lawyers, like they did not want us doing this at all. And at the end of the day, we just said, is this going to come and, you know, come back to bite us on certain jobs? Like, yeah, but at the end of the day, those are the clients we don't want, right? Because we think that if we can, if everybody has all the information as soon as possible, it gives us the best opportunity to get around the table and solve the problem. So, yeah.
Difference,
right?
Between like, difference between a problem and a decision, how fast you tell me.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, again, like I don't have like an something that would solve it for the industry, but what can we do? What can we tackle? Right. Like,
well, you are though. I mean, Suffolk's a leader in the industry. People look to Suffolk for everything they're doing. They're mimicked anywhere I look, right? And that's what we need, right? We need good stewards. We need good leaders to look up to. That dashboard right there, just saying that. Now, anybody listening, that's a great opportunity to say too, there's another thing here. Like you've said it a couple times. Maybe not every client's a good client. And maybe I also want to double down on the clients that are great to work with. And that's good business in the end. Yeah. So I like that. I really think taking the steps, that dashboard's fantastic. I'd love to know how that, I mean, and you to win that legal battle, good on you. Those are the big steps.
I working for a privately held firm with a visionary like John Fish makes those things a lot easier. I've worked for publicly held companies. It's hard. It's hard to get things like that done. I have to give like all the credit to just, you know, John Suffolk, the executive board, their leadership on stuff like that. Those things are hard to get done at like large public organizations.
Yeah, very different. And that's why some of our large privately held can really innovate and can change.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Jacob. I'm sure you got some future questions because I want to dig in. Alexis is changing now, but I'm sure you're changing future too, or thinking about future.
Always.
Jeff mentioned there's people looking up to you guys now. What are you guys doing? What is stuff that you're pushing on job sites right now that you're really trying to do? I think you've mentioned digital delivery before. What is that in your mind? And then also, what is next year, 2 years of stuff that you want to start seeing, that you want to really push, or stuff that you've tried and that you want standardized almost on Suffolk projects coming forward?
Sure. I'm not sure my answer will be kind of what, you know, your traditional audience might be looking for. But what I'm most excited about is bigger than our department, is bigger than the digital engineering department. It's our mission control platform. We are a part of that platform, which, you know, I'm really proud of because, you know, on a day-to-day basis, a lot of what my team, right, we do might look like traditional best-in-class BDC, but we are a part of a bigger play, right? We're a part of a bigger strategy, and we are, and it feels good, right? Like, it helps me recruit, helps me keep my team members engaged and excited to, like, get after it every day. It certainly does for me that we're part of a bigger strategy and a bigger plan. And so our platform, think about this. Think about a project team on a project trying to build something very complex, a $500 million hospital, right, whatever, and needing to make sure that they do every little step, every meeting, every agenda item, every process, every piece, right, incorporate every lessons learned, incorporate the latest and greatest technology appropriately to get value out of it, like all of these things while they're trying to, right, get to contract, get in the ground, buy out, bill, turnover, all that stuff, commissioning, right? And like, how do we arm them with exactly what they need at the exact right moment, right? So that they don't have to like kind of worry about all of that stuff in the background. And like, that's our platform, right? And it's people, it's process, it's technology, but it's built on a data platform, a common data environment. And I'm like very proud when I talk about this. Like, we're on our 10th year of our data journey. We have 35 data scientists. We have a clean data lake, and now we've gotten into predictive analytics. So one of the coolest things, I think, is our tripwires. So we've defined when we will, like, what are the things that happen that will lead to a safety issue, a safety incident, or fee erosion, right, or schedule issue. And like, we can predict ahead of time and then go swarm the job. So tripwire is tripped, all eyes on that job, right? And so that makes me like extremely proud to work here, just that we're at that point and that our team, my department like plays a role in that. And we also have like 40 years of data, right? We've just celebrated our 40th year last year. And the fact that we know what the design was when it got to us, and then we know what we built, like through our digital delivery process, which we can go into, right? Jacob Via Technica is one of our partners on this process. We can now take that evolution of design to as-built through our repository of construction models to train our AI and to start designing and building differently, right? And my team, digital engineering, pushing the digital delivery process, right? So for you old school BIM folks, think of like the old school control model concept, right? We are not using design models. We are modeling in a construction sequence with, fabrication level detail, like, and making sure that it actually all works, and finding the RFIs earlier and asking them before they have cost and risk associated with them. And then ending up with something that we built with all the same metadata, right? Like construction models, and having that across our portfolio. So for us, like, that's the bigger picture of the team. It's not just like going out and coordinating this job and laser scanning this job and modeling this job. And you know what I mean? Like, yes, we always do all that, of course, right? But there's a bigger, that's, I guess, to answer your question, like, that's what we're focused on. And that's the strategy that then feeds back, right? Suffolk design, Suffolk construction, right? Back into that loop to get closer to, at least this is me personally now speaking, like my ultimate goal of being able to tell a client, give me your DDs. Here's how we will build it. 60, you know, whatever it is, right? We like to moonshot it at 30 days. Again, that's like more of a guiding light than potentially reality, but it gets us amped for the day to get after it, you know?
Yeah, but you even mentioned when we were talking about like the idea of the digital twin inside of construction and this DD to digital twin, you mentioned, I don't know how to actually get there. I don't have the answer on how to get there or what we do. And really, I think you guys are showing that you're making steps to that actual answer. It's a matter of resources, right? Like putting those resources that far up front and getting this information correct, or putting that amount of resources into building a model that is that correct, that it can be built off of, and it has the correct stuff in it. It's a matter of building those resources in and getting there. I think it's really cool because you might say, we, you know, it's a really far jump. It's really far away, but you guys really are making strides to that. And here's the first steps to it. Here's the first step. I mean, you got to have clean data. You got to have it modeled correctly. And then you can start using it to actually make decisions off of. And it's really cool. I personally did not know as much about the data scientists and how big your data lake is. I mean, one of my biggest things right now is working with construction data, handing it to an owner, and what's that process in the middle? Because we got to clean it, we got to validate it, we got to hand it over, then populate other systems, which all of which, anything like that is wrong, it kills every bit of the operation. There's all the value kind of goes out the window. So I applaud Suffolk in this and everything. And with that digital engineering, with these great models, what do you want to do next with them?
Just to kind of, you know, reiterate what I said, I want to give them to Suffolk Design, right? And I want them to, our design team and our engineering team and our new AI team are working together to build a platform where it's kind of, you know, we lovingly kind of call it, you know, the tech-enabled master builder, right? We want an architect and an engineer on our team to use their time and their brain power to do this really smart and creative things. And we don't want them to have to figure out that this detail, you know, design level detail always actually ends up getting built this way. Like, we already know that. So we'll just have the tech tell them that and populate that and model that. And like, they don't have to worry about that. So, you know, my goal today is to take all of the data from our projects in terms of the 3D environment, what actually ended up where, and give it back to the design team for the next project to just continuously kind of, like I said, compress that time period it takes to get to even a buildable set of drawings, right? I mean, we're all tired of talking about how bad the drawings are, and mostly out of our hands. And as long as clients keep, you know, commoditizing good design, I don't think our design partners kind of have a fair chance. I mean, they are just squeezed. Do you know what I mean? Why in the world would an architect create a model that I could use? They're not incentivized to do that, right? Like, I can't blame them. I can't blame them for drawings that are missing details. It's how they're hired to work. So what are we going to do about it? Instead of letting project teams on their own kind of, like, in my mind, I feel like when we get handed a set of drawings, the risk is already there. We don't have control over it. All the omissions, the errors, the conflicts, the questions exist already. And it just takes time to get them out of that set of drawings. And the longer it takes, the more risk and more dollars it will result in. So if we can not lower the amount of RFIs, but shift the timing of those RFIs, right, through this process, like that's, I don't know, I always kind of think of like, if I'm going in to pitch to a client, like how can I, like how would I pitch this? What would I want to say? And then we come back and we build that. Right. Like, oh, I wish I could tell my client this. This would answer their pain points. Well, let's just go build that.
Well, that's a thing. You said a couple of things in there that are fantastic. 10-year journey, right? This does not happen overnight. And I think there's a number of people out there who want it to. And it's like, no, you got to get boots on the ground and going. There's people who are 10 years ahead of you with 35 data scientists that it took to get to predictive analytics, right? Mm-hmm. To get to a point that we've been talking about for a very long time because it's complicated. And, you know, there is this misnomer in AI that it like removes jobs. You just said it. It just shifts, pulls out those decisions. And in fact, many of them will be quote unquote solved, right? Because we're going to know that these RFIs are answered this way 90% of the time. So would you like us to propose that we solve this way? That's the tech putting it in front of you. And you're going to go, oh yeah, because this is the 9 out of 10. Oh, this is the 1 out of 10. Okay. I'm going to handle the exception, right? Managed by exception. But also I love that you said you're bringing the RFIs to the point where there's before cost and before risk. That's when we want to answer things. That's when we want those questions posed. We don't want them posed under the gun because we make bad decisions under the gun. We're driven by the wrong thing. So again, you're making this iterative process faster, better, and cleaner. And not throwing the blame game. You know, we so many times when we're talking, we're like, well, you just fix you. How about we just worry about us?
Drawings are bad, right? Like the, you know what I mean? Like decisions were made late. It's like there's a million fingers to point. So why don't we just solve for that? And again, like I'm not going to blame the architect. Do you know what I mean? Like talked about that. Like let's just fill the gap. Let's just solve it and solve it smartly and not, you know, be bitter about it.
Yeah. When one finger's pointed, three fingers are pointed back at you. So just let's work on ourselves. So I want to take 1 minute to give you a final, like some of the things on the job site, a lot of this digital delivery, a lot of this work can drive innovation on the actual job site. So you've talked about, you know, assembly on the job site, et cetera. I'm wondering, what are some of your other predictions for things that through this digital process can then be enabled on the job site for us?
Well, I don't know if I'm your gal for this, but I will do my best. In my perfect world, teams like my, you know, our digital engineering team, VDC teams are dissolved. They go away, right? And everyone is using the model like they use drawings and they are all paired with robotics, right? So you have this kind of, you know, bionic man or woman situation. I mean, not legitimately, not like in a weird outfit, because like I just, that might be real. That's not the world I want to like envision. But right, but everybody's got, you know, whether, right, just to use what we've got today, their Spot, their Rugged Robotics, their, you know what I mean? Like kind of paired with them helping to do a part of this process. And they don't need teams like our team, right? Like that would be the goal. I mean, that's the dream. So today, right, we're just looking for better ways, I think, to capture reality and integrate it into the process. The faster, right? I don't want anybody like pulling tapes. You know what I mean? I don't want anybody kind of like, oh, I don't have time to check before the pour. Do you know what I mean? Like, how do we actually capture, validate, fix, check as fast as possible? Right. I mean, for me, and then work overnight. Like, I love the idea that you can just like set something like a Aruba essentially and like leave, and then you show up, and a lot of that manual stuff is done. I love that idea. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, I think that all goes back to like robotics on site. And for me in particular, I'm really interested in reality capture. So,
hey, I know you said you weren't, but that really was it. That was awesome. Alexis, thank you so much for sitting down with us here.
You're welcome.
You're not leaving us. That was a great mic drop moment. You're not leaving us because we're going to get in and bring you with us on the construction technology news of the week. Jacob, what do you got for me, buddy?
All right. So going through supply chain dive, this one caught my eye. Definitely, if you've listened to any of the podcasts I've done with Jeff this year, I have talked about ESG nonstop as this will be the year that everybody throws their money into it. But what I love here is Ford, GM, Honda collaborate on standardized scope 3 emissions reporting. I love when I see big companies have to come together to actually solve problems. So if you don't know what scope 3 is, scope 3 is your consultants and the emissions that your consultants, the people you pay to do work for you, you have to track that in ESG goals. And that is a huge pain in the ass. So here we are. They came together and they put a form, a way to fill out your emission scores and provide it back to these big companies. This is the same way, Jeff, I believe you mentioned this before, the airlines got together and all the airlines put together to actually standardize the way that they put out cost information, ticketing information, and flights. And it's good. I love seeing this. I even, you know, might have planted this one with Suffolk on the call as like, hey, is this more stuff that you guys could see doing with other big companies? But I'm not putting you on the spot, Alexis. You can comment on the article, but I love seeing it. I love seeing the idea of this. This has got to be how problems are solved when it's this big. If not, then we just end up with 1,800 different ways to do something and nothing gets standardized. So,
yeah, Jacob, I'm going to jump in. I agree with you. This came up pretty heavily in a conversation I had with a lot of CERT members. And the future of ESG, because a lot of materials themselves have one impact, but getting them shipped, getting them delivered, and getting them installed isn't measured evenly. And I think there's a large sentiment amongst the owners of we want to drive our ESG goals forward, but we want to be working on a level playing field, an even playing field. And this is another example of big companies saying, okay, here's the even playing field. Now let's go. And I think that's going to be one of the critical components to how we get and measure true ESG goals, right? Not some faux goal that we're capable of fudging and removing my delivery from it or removing what's going on at a factory where some of these parts and pieces are being assembled and manufactured. And, you know, if they're, you know, being manufactured with really caustic, environmentally heavily impacted, but the product itself's not, then that's not fair. So I like it. I like this kind of standardization. I like this teaming, right? It's part of teaming. And I mean, we can say this a lot. We don't play on a level playing field all the time. Business is not a fair game, but at least some of it should be. I'm interested, Alexis, what are your thoughts on it?
I was listening to a podcast recently, and I'm going to screw up kind of like the nomenclature and the language and everything, but the large accelerator, particle accelerator over in Europe, right? And every country that participates pays like a nominal fee every year, and they can actually get a lot done, right? So to your point, like them coming together for the greater good, and like so many discoveries are happening in, you know, like the edge of physics and engineering, right? That end up in our hospitals, right? And you know, if you've got cancer and you're being treated with technology that came from that. And then I suppose that they tried to build one in Texas and they built half of it. And then Congress like shut down funding and they just like filled in the tunnel. And so, right. And like, it was going to be better than the one in Europe and it was going to bring, you know, like amazing discoveries. And so, yes, I feel like, you know, if we can band together for the greater good and get things done, It's a tricky thing to do in the United States.
Yeah.
Yep.
We culturally aren't really set up well to do that, considering, you know, and I'm not going to get into the political side of this, but considering leadership changes so often, right? And, you know, and whatnot. So anyway, right? And I get this question a lot, too, because I work for companies that have offices, you know, in other parts of the world. And why can they do so many cool things in Singapore? How come the BIM department is like amazing over, you know what I mean, in parts of Asia, and you guys can't get anything done? I was like, it's mandated by the government.
Yeah, right.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know if I really like answered your question. I mean, like, yes, but right. It's a tricky thing to keep, you know, the lobbyists out of it, you know, and competing priorities. And I don't know. I don't have a better answer for you on that one.
No, no apologies. That's a good one. Cause it is that it's reality is it's a different environment here.
Yeah.
It just truly is. And so it's good to see this. It's good to see other industries that can do it. And we can keep reaching, right? Yeah. We got to have those BHAGs and we can go for them, but it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. I mean, what I've experienced too, like in my career is with work, traveling to other countries and seeing how they do things, right? And kind of collaborating in that way. Like for instance, like, you know, going to Australia and seeing like the way that they handle safety and then coming back here or worker welfare and going, it's like, we're so primitive here. We're still going to have people using like, you know, porta-johns and stuff. Like we're not really taking care of our people. Like, what does that say about us? Right. And like going and traveling again, like, and just seeing how they do it, what their standards are in other countries and trying to bring that back here. Like cocoons, not that long ago, we didn't cocoon buildings. Yep. And now it's like in a big city, would you even think about doing it with that one? Be like the dark ages.
All right, Jacob, what else you got for us, buddy?
All right. Second one is, media announcement from March 26th. So the media announcement is Nemeshek Group partners with Hexagon. This is right through my alley. I love this one. It's the D-Twin software that they're pushing out. And really, they've decided to go together. So Nemeshek Group is the one that built D-Twin. And it's a cloud-based digital twin system, but they open sourced it. And now Hexagon has seen the value in it. So they are going to partner and help push this idea of digital transformation. So D-Twin really is a delivery tool right now for aggregating all the data from design and construction, putting it to a tool they can kind of hand over. What's really neat is Hexagon is that reality capture giant. I mean, they kind of have just about everything now, and they are going to be partnering. So this is something that gives them a huge step forward. I think this gives something of, hey, a lot of the missing stuff from BIM is making sure that we have that reality to it and that reality capture and what is truly there. I think this actually starts providing that. I think this gives you all the photos together. This gives you everything with point clouds. I'm excited. I'm excited to see it. D-Twin has some big thoughts and ideas, and it should be pushed forward, but Nemeshek Group is pretty good at what they do. So I'm hoping to see this really get pushed forward and see what we can get.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's good to see this kind of a replication of what Alexis talked about earlier of a common data environment, somewhere for us to centrally push information that can then be pulled or utilized more easily later. And open source is a great opportunity. I mean, most other industries have it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know this is more your world. And so I read it. Can't say I understood it all, but I'm very excited for a common data environment. I'm probably missing something. But Alexis, I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
Yeah, well, I didn't get a chance to read it. You're pulling these on me, Jacob. But what's the basis of the partnership? Is it a merger, an acquisition? Is it
no? It's strategic partnership. So there's no purchase, nothing. It's just a matter of I think Hexagon really didn't want to go build their own digital twin solution. I think they saw the opportunity to really leverage what Nemeshek Group is doing and go build on top of it.
Even so I like that. Yeah. I like that. I think I'm a little salty just when it's like massive acquisitions. Do you know what I mean? And you know what I mean? It's rare at least that I feel like I've seen an acquisition that just kind of doesn't stall out once acquired. Right. or die on the vine, or no one actually goes to integrate the code very well with like the existing firm's like platform. So I love that. I love strategic partnerships. I mean, that's a great way to kind of get things done without having to build or buy. So, right. And like I said, I mean, I want to move closer and closer to a true like virtual environment with real information, because then there's nothing to argue about. There's nothing to question. There's nothing to hedge, right? It's like, it is what it is. And we're all looking at it before we build it. And let's just take, you know, the uncertainty, the egos all out of it. We've captured reality. So anything in that space, I'm excited about. So send me the link to that article so I can read it.
Yeah, we'll send it to you. I like that one too, Jacob. And I like what you're saying, Alexis, because I wish more people in our industry, more software companies in our industry had the wherewithal to keep on going and reach their true potential. Because you know, look at things like the iPhone, right? We all use a number of different of the largest platforms there are, whether you're Google, Apple, Microsoft, we're all running on those phones now. The ability of Apple to open up their ecosystem and vice versa is actually what grows all those companies. So this business partnerships, even for competitors at times, is really good for the end user in the end, and actually will grow them both. I mean, then things just become ubiquitous. You don't expect to open up, you know, I open up Excel on my iPad all the time and work on it. You know, I open up Word and work on it all the time. I don't even think twice. And I can remember back when that was a tricky situation. And yeah. So again, it's just making that data more accessible and better. And, you know, we do set our guests up, just so you guys know, they know more than you do before they get onto the show sometimes. And it's our job to explain better. So we didn't explain as well as we should. Alexis, though, you grabbed the nugget that we needed from there. Anything last on that one?
Still Monday morning. So
yeah. It's a Monday. It is. All right, Jacob. Well, thank you. I'm going to go to an interesting one that's going to be quick and easy, but tech companies find the edge of the internet. Everybody knows I'm a big Morning Brew fan. If you listen in, get a lot of my news from them in Tech Brew. OpenAI reportedly developed a tool that transcribes audio from YouTube videos. Basically, I love this quote. In 1974, Shel Silverstein found where the sidewalk ends. In 2024, tech company found where the internet ends. Basically, our large language models, our models are so big that we've consumed the internet. And it's getting a little weird, because with limited human-created content left to scrape, some companies have reportedly begun developing synthetic information. Yes, that means using AI to create content that will be used to train the same AI. So we have reached a moment in time. You know, we used to kid all the time that you'll never reach the end of the internet. Well, a human clicking a button is never going to reach the end of the internet, but we've created in a lot of these, AI models, the ability to get there. Jacob, I'm interested. How do you feel about reaching the end of the internet?
I feel like that we've created a cyclical black hole now. And basically, it's just going to keep consuming itself. And now there is no end or edge of the internet, because it just keeps going round and round. And I don't know. I mean, is that what's going to finally break everything? this is
where you
like
open up your screen share, man, and with another screen share, with another screen share, and eventually just shut your graphics card down. Yeah, the window, boom, it's gone. We've reached that point of the internet.
I mean, it's crazy to think about, and I think this is like one of those mind blowing instances. But I mean, what breaks that then it learns, and then it keeps teaching itself something broken.
Well, I mean, we have to use synthetic data in our industry now, because there's just not enough building data. So, like, we're already doing that. And if you look at, like, you know, the change in things like codes over time, you can't necessarily go back and look at all the structural design data because the code has changed. Yeah. Right. So it's not, you know what I mean? And there's just not enough. So we're already using synthetic data in our industry. I don't know what that means.
I don't know what it means, but somebody out there who's smarter than me, if you know what it means, give me a call, give me an email, drop me a line on LinkedIn. We'll bring you on and we'll talk about the realities of synthetic data and where we're wrong and right.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was an interesting one. When I read that, I was like, it's got to go on the show.
Yeah.
This last one's an interesting one. It's a video, so nobody could have really seen it. But this is Mad Money with host Jim Cramer, who brought on Kevin Murphy, the CEO of Ferguson, the largest plumbing and HVAC distributor. And they touch on a number of different things, not only just the growth of Ferguson and where they are, but also a lot of what we've talked about. They supply so much of the commercial world, especially when it comes to the CHIPS Act and what we're seeing grow in the EV batteries and the different plants across the country that are growing and booming, these mega projects. And yeah, of course, it's Cramer, so they're going to talk about the stock. The stock's continually going up. But what I thought was really interesting was a couple of the things that Kevin Murphy talked about when they're changing their approach. Right. This used to be they talked to the trades, right? And the trades dealt with everything. They're now repositioning themselves to really talk to general contractors about understanding the supply chain and understanding the availability. They're changing the conversation with owners. They're investing in all those things and they're still focused with their trade contractors, but they're starting to widen and broaden their view in understanding that this world's changing and changing fast. So I know, Jacob, you're involved in a lot of that, how this world's changing, especially as we, you know, look at these unbelievable mega projects.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost to the point that they have to be involved, right? We saw something over COVID where supply chain stopped at points. And it hurt so many things because we couldn't expect it. And it basically paused things to whole projects to, you know, people being able to sell computers, video cards. I mean, it's just all over the place. It's certain supply chains kind of just stopped the world from turning in certain points. For them to be that active and be able to start providing information to GCs, to, you know, owners of what their supply chain capability, especially somebody that has like this much effect on it, is something that it's necessary at this point. I think it goes back to Alexis's digital twin dream of all that information in there. I mean, if we can put the manufacturer's information in there and they know that we're 10 months out from purchasing, you know, so much linear feet of carbon fiber pipe, then they're going to be better prepared for it too. This type of stuff is really where it's going to go. Ferguson is another one of Viatechnics partners that we've been doing great stuff with. And I hope that they continue down that road. It's very exciting to see their CEO go on Cramer and talk about this. That's really big. That's really shows them that they're continuing to do it. Now there's a bunch of people behind him that have to kind of, you know, meet those ideas, and that's why Suffolk has people like Alexis to go do it correctly, right?
Somebody's got to set a moonshot, and then Alexis, you get to go run and see what happens. I'm interested in how your perception, Alexis, from your seat on the way suppliers like Ferguson and others are changing the conversation with your groups.
Can I admit that you put the link to this one in the invite and I watched the video? And
yes, you can.
I actually thought the labor conversation was really interesting, and their discussion about why aren't more people getting construction jobs. Right? They pay well. You don't have to go spend $100,000 a year at a university. We talk about this all the time. Like, we just don't have enough people across the entire construction, right? From even the like executives and the, you know, the office and the project management and the field staff and the labor and the trades, like, you know, all of that. And I kind of thought, okay, so these are really good jobs and these are good paying jobs, right? But it reminded me of articles I've read in the past about high rates of suicide in the trades, right? And I don't know necessarily you know, I don't have the answer. I don't know like the reason for those, but some of the things have been, you know, the fact that it's feast or famine in construction. So you have a really good job and then you don't have a job, you have to move, weird hours, dangerous, right? Like all of these things, right? Potentially for the high rate of suicide. And I thought, well, now that we've got like AI and robotics coming in, could we actually like remove some of those things that make these types of jobs so stressful that someone might want to take their own life, and just focus on the good parts of these jobs? You're building something. You're building every day. You're using your body. You're interacting with, you know, people. You have purpose. You're building potentially like a hospital, you know, a bridge, a road, you know what I mean? Something beautiful that will stand the test of time. You can look at it. Like how many people can drive down through a city and go, I built that. It's a good feeling, right? So it's could a we, great right? So could we, you know, like there's a lot of like apathy, right? In our society nowadays, a lack of meaning and purpose. Could we actually help build back some of the trades, you know, the labor and the trades with like these like really meaningful jobs and remove like with technology, some of those things that push people to the edge, right? I don't know.
I think I'm glad you pulled that part out because that was, you know, I remember an interview with Mike Rowe after the first time he paused Dirty Jobs. And he said, you know, the most interesting thing I learned in this whole thing was how many millionaires I was working with that just don't get credit for being millionaires because we don't look at that labor as having that kind of upside, but it does. I'm going to tie something you talked about earlier in this, Alexis, and that is if we are better at planning, scheduling, design for manufacturing and assembly, predictability, we can level off a ton of those problems that are experienced in the trades. A lot of it are those long nights, those emergencies that we don't need. You said it's feast or famine. We have more work than we know what to do with. If we can plan it correctly, if we can schedule it correctly, and we can be honest about it, we can create no feast and no famine. We can create exactly what we need, a supply chain that continues, people that can predict and count on how their business can grow, who can grow it and hire people and go to schools and go to other places and recruit, knowing we're always going to have a job for them. Yeah. We're always going to have this work. Here's where we're at. And look, if we can also use technology to measure, a lot of the folks I talk to in the trades are deployed away from family. We don't track how long they're away from family and we treat them horribly. We'll let that, you know, someone's partner will have, I mean, this not their house partner, but their work partner will have a weekend off. And so they'll work an extra weekend and then they'll go to get their weekend back and they don't get it. And we don't raise those types of red flags. We don't do that type of stuff. So you can bring this all back to the beginning of if we are better planners, if we are better digital, if we are better in all those ways, and we drive design for manufacturing assembly and we drive predictability, we can serve that group much better.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, hey, listen, this has been awesome. That went beautifully. Alexis, thanks for sitting down for the whole show with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. It was fun.
It's great. Yeah. Can't wait to see you out there somewhere. Jacob, it's great to have you, buddy.
One last time. It's great to be a Florida Gator.
Go Gators.
Go Gators.
Go editors, get that one out. No. Thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Alexis McGuffin. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.